morning, or good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. The Senate Judiciary Committee, we have four bills that are scheduled today, two of them that are scheduled as public hearings and possible work sessions, another two that are set for a public hearing. I have two councils that are going to be working on the, with the committee today, so we may jump out of order a little bit, but we are going to start at the top with Senate Bill 1527. So I'm opening up a public hearing on 1527. Council?
Good afternoon, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Newell. First up, we have Senate Bill 1527, which comes to you from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. It has no revenue, no impact, or fiscal impact statement. The original measure specifies that cheating is a Class A misdemeanor. There is a proposed amendment, the -5 amendments, which replaces the original measure and amends ORS 163-187. That's the strangulation statute. It is a one-word fix, and it changes the word conviction to the word crime.
All righty. So I have three people that are scheduled at this point that have signed up for 1527. Aaron, Jean, and Daryl. Why don't you three please come up? Are there going to be any, is there anyone else here today who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 1527? If you do, raise your hand so I can just see what my count is. All right, thank you very much. Hi.
Good afternoon, Chair. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Department of Justice. Prior to that position, I was a line prosecutor for Marion and Yamhill County for about 12 years.
Good afternoon, Chair Brzezinski and committee members. My name is Jean Kunkel. I work for the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I've worked there for 22 years, and I'm in charge of the domestic violence trial team.
Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association.
All right, who would like to start off our presentation? I'm assuming we're going to be talking about the dash fives as to what the reason for those are and what they actually do. I understand we do not know what dash ones through four were or is because no one has shared them with the chair. So we're going with the dash fives. Aaron?
Thank you. Yes, Chair. I don't know what dashes one through four are. I'm here to speak to you about dash five and specifically the one-word fix for the strangulation bill. As the Chair, I'm sure, is aware, last year, House Bill 2940 passed. It was the strangulation bill. The 2009 draft of that bill, I think, at the last moment was sort of resurrected, and this is what we enacted. The keen eye of Ms. Kunkel caught this, I don't know if it was a scrivener's error or typo. Essentially, the strangulation bill, what it did was in certain situations, it elevated what was a misdemeanor strangulation to a felony strangulation. One of those situations in which a strangulation was elevated was when the victim of a previous either assault, menacing, or strangulation was the same victim as in the current offense or crime. What happened is in subsection 4E of the bill and the law that was passed, instead of saying the current offense or crime, says current conviction, which you can't have because the person hasn't yet been convicted. So that's the fix that we're requesting, is simply from the word conviction to the word crime, and we've requested crime because it's then consistent with the verbiage and the remainder of the bill.
Jean?
I have nothing to add here.
Daryl?
Same.
I love it. Questions for the panel? One word fix. Going once. Going twice. We'll close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1527.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendment into Senate Bill 1527.
All right. Senator Cruz moves that we amend Senate Bill 1527 by adding the dash 5s to the bill. Any discussion? Any objection? The order?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1527 as amended by the dash 5 amendment along with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz now moves Senate Bill 1527 as amended by the dash 5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I hear discussion to my right.
No, it's not relevant.
Not relevant. Okay. Any other discussion that might be relevant? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing or hearing any? So order? I believe I was the carrier last time, so I'll go ahead and put the chair down for a carrier on 1527. And with that, we'll close the work session on 1527. And we're going to go ahead and drop down to public hearing on Senate Bill 1534. And at this point, Bill, we're going to go ahead and do 1534 instead of 1528 at this point. So I have 1534. Okay. What's your name?
Hi. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, we now have Senate Bill 1534, sponsored by Senator Whitsitt. This does not have a revenue impact statement. We are still waiting for the fiscal impact statement. It has no amendments and no subsequent referrals. This bill creates the crime of aggravated solicitation, specifically with the means of electronic communications. Under current Oregon law, we have the crime of solicitation when a person with the intent to cause another to engage in specific criminal conduct commands or solicits another person to engage in that criminal conduct. In recent years, there have been incidences where large groups of people, presumably communicating through electronic communications, have gone into stores and robbed them as a group. This is in response to those sorts of incidences. It specifies that if the violation solicited is a Class A felony, then the aggravated solicitation will also be a Class A felony, and so on.
All right. We have a number of people who have signed up for to give testimony today. For those who have not given testimony before, if you have written testimony, please hand that in. We will read your testimony, so we'd prefer you not to read line by line, word by word, but tell us from the heart if you are as to summarizing what's on the written document if you have written testimony. If you hear other people giving testimony before you and it's very similar to what you would be saying, you can just say, we agree or I agree with this other person, and you do not need to necessarily go through and repeat it all again. With that, I have looks like we're going to have three panels today. Senator Whitsitt?
May I make an opening statement?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The term flash mob describes the use of an electronic device to actively and willfully and intentionally solicit the committing of a crime by a group of people at a specific location, at a specific time, such as we're all going to arrive at Joe's jewelry store at 4:55 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon, and we're going to rob him blind. I mean, that's basically, this has been happening. I think you see in the report here that at least 8% of the retailers in the United States have experienced that sort of a situation. Notwithstanding the fact that this bill is 22 pages long, the only important information is on the front page, and that page basically states that the bill creates the crime of aggravated solicitation to commit a crime. The relevant language, a person commits the crime of aggravated solicitation if, with the intent of causing two or more other persons to engage in specific conduct constituting a crime, the person uses electronic communication to command or solicit other persons to engage in that conduct at a specific time, at a specific location. The current law essentially penalizes solicitation at one level lower than if you actually committed the crime in general. This bill is narrowly drafted to require the person sending the electronic communication to have the specific intent of causing two or more other persons to engage in a specific conduct constituting a crime. In short, it is the highest mental standard. Intentionality is required here. Knowing, reckless, or gross negligence is not sufficient for the person to be guilty of aggravated solicitation. The actual determination by the court of the intent to solicit, after the actual determination of the court of the intent to solicit committing a crime, is not changed. That is intentionality. Once the court has decided that you have in fact solicited a crime, after that, the court will determine the potential penalty, and that potential penalty may be more if you use an electronic device. Otherwise, it really doesn't change the procedure for determining if you actively solicited a crime. It is carefully worded to address a person electronically soliciting a specific crime by a group of people at a specific location at a specific time. I've heard concerns about, Mr. Chair, about search and seizure, where law enforcement officers may grab your cell phone or your electronic device and look through it. Mr. Chair, I would submit that that is currently a violation of the search and seizure laws, the search and seizure protections in the Constitution, and this doesn't change that. And that's the bill in a nutshell. It is a pretty simple bill, and I think it's needed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Wissett. As I said, we're going to call up people in panels of three. It appears by looking at this, looks like everyone who has signed up are in opposition to the bill. And so we will just start off with the top of the list. I've got Dan Meek, Eric, I believe it's Coker, and Christopher Legg. And what I need each of you to do when it's your turn to give testimony, please identify yourself for the record and then tell us what you want to say. All right, Dan? I'm going to let you go first since you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Meek. I'm representing today the Oregon Progressive Party. I've been an attorney in practice in Portland for 32 years. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. Let's say that I'm at home watching television and I see that there's a protest going on in downtown Portland. The protesters are not obeying police orders to disperse or get off the street or get out of Pioneer Courthouse Square, for example. I then send email to two of my friends saying, let's go down there now and join the crowd. Under this bill, I've committed a Class C felony that is punishable by 5 years in prison and a fine of $125,000. It's the same if I communicate by email to two persons or if I do this via blog post or tweet. In fact, it's the same felony if the email is never received or if no one reads the blog post and no one reads the tweet. It's still a Class C felony under this bill. This bill is a lot different than existing laws when it comes to solicitation. Existing laws don't make it a felony to solicit a misdemeanor. This bill does. It makes it a felony, for example, there are hundreds of misdemeanors under state and local law. Among them is the making of unreasonable noise. Let me find my little list here. Under state law, disturbing any lawful assembly of persons, obstructing vehicular or pedestrian traffic on a public way, or congregates with other persons in a public place and refuses to comply with a lawful order of the police to disperse. Those are all misdemeanors, but under this law, merely suggesting that or merely composing a suggestion that is never received by anyone, if I intend it to be received by two or more persons, is a felony, and we have the 5 years and potential massive fine. This also law allows law enforcement to use subpoenas and search warrants to obtain the contents of email and other electronic communications because this law criminalizes the electronic communication itself. It's the communication that is a crime, and that will enable law enforcement agencies, as I say, to obtain subpoenas and search warrants, send them to ISPs, get email traffic, not just the traffic, but the actual contents, and also obtain records from web hosts, from blogs, and from Twitter. I have to say, this is the kind of law I would expect to see in Myanmar, Turkmenistan, North Korea, or Zimbabwe, but not in Oregon.
Eric?
Thank you. My name is Eric Coker. I am a PhD student at Oregon State University. I am here today to stand in opposition to SB 1534. I am extremely disturbed at how this law would encroach on citizens' ability to organize online, whether it be to do a protest, whether it to be to do something as simple as a flash mob, something like that. The statistic that Senator Wetzit points out of 8% businesses being affected by this is pretty odd, but what I would say is this law would inhibit somebody, let's go back in history, it would inhibit somebody like, let's say, Dr. Martin Luther King from saying, that Selma bridge over there or that bus over there, you know, we can organize to, you know, it would have prevented something as simple as the Selma Bridge protest, and all those people would have been subject to, if they had have heard about it via electronic communication, they would have all been subject to a Class C felony. So that's the provision of the law, along with the provisions referred to by the gentleman to the left of me. You know, I have a petition that has just been alive for less than 48 hours and already has roughly 200 signatures. And you know, if this bill does somehow make it past committee, expect extreme opposition to such a bill to prevent people's freedom of speech online, to organize, and to do what our founding fathers said we had the right to do.
Christopher.
Yes, I'm Christopher Legg. I'm an architectural designer out of Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm here to voice my opposition to Senate Bill 1534. I'd just like to reiterate, as the other gentlemen have said, this makes it a crime, makes the act of communicating with other people a crime, not the crime itself. And as Senator Whitsitt points out, it's what makes a crime aggravated solicitation versus the existing solicitation laws is the fact that you've communicated electronically. It doesn't take into account the severity of the crime or even the number of people you're soliciting. It's just two people is enough to make it aggravated solicitation if it's done electronically. And I think that's a large change from the existing laws, and to me it seems like it is a severe encroachment on our freedom of speech and freedom of assembly online. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you. Stay right there for a moment. Is there any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you for really anyone who wants to respond. This bill would only affect the person who is organizing. So the person, anyone who is responding to it, there is no criminality involved in receiving the message. There is no criminality involved in anything unless actually you went out and did and committed a crime, which you would be liable for anyway. The only person here who would be liable for a crime is the person who intentionally and willfully solicited the committing of a crime using an electronic device. And that's a pretty steep, in my opinion, a pretty steep sideboard. When we crafted the wording on this bill, we made every intention to protect the freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. So the question is, did you understand that it's only the person soliciting, not the people responding?
Yeah, I understand that. But by the nature of this kind of event, virtually any time someone participates in something like a flash mob, they've not only received an invitation to it online, but they've then forwarded that invitation out to their friends. And that's what makes the flash mob that's how they work. And so virtually any person participating in it could also be charged with solicitation under the way this is written.
Certainly anyone who responded to it and forwarded it to another person would be doing the same act, soliciting a crime, yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if no one can suggest a protest, then, or to organize a protest, then the protest doesn't happen. So you're taking out a key element, and that is the element of communicating with others that a protest is going to occur. Number two is you indicated that the purpose of this was to avoid flash mobs that do such things as robbery. Robbery is not a misdemeanor. But this law, this bill, makes it a Class C felony to commit a misdemeanor, to suggest that two people commit a misdemeanor. So this certainly does seem to be, whether it's aimed at eliminating the organization of protests, that would certainly be its effect, to criminalize the organization of protests.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to include, I believe it's Rachel Green, Dylan Swartz, Marie Purcell, I believe. So I'm just going to go off the top of the list. So Rachel?
Yes, my name is Rachel Green, and I just wanted to reiterate what has already been said on the subject. Thank you. Thank you.
Dylan?
I'm in complete agreement with everything that's been said on this subject so far. And I think that in terms of taking a look at the legalities of this, that it seems to be a clear obligation that this can't go forward. This is inappropriate. All right, that's all my comment. All right. Marie?
Yes, my name is Marie Purcell. I'm also from Corvallis, and some of us have come up for this hearing. I am opposed to Senate Bill 1534. The internet is a form of communication similar to the mail and the telephone. To have our present laws protect, are adequate to criminal issues. They're adequate to prosecuting criminal issues. We don't need extra laws specific to one form of communication. That's the first thing. Second, if a crime is a misdemeanor, it should only be prosecuted as such, and if it's a felony, it prosecuted as such. It should, the method by which it's prosecuted shouldn't be dependent on the way it is planned, by what form of communication, word of mouth or the internet, but mainly any law specific to internet communication and organization would have a chilling effect on free speech and freedom of association. One cannot guarantee the actions of everyone who might read one's post. And the chilling effect on freedom of speech and the change of the person who's sending out a post saying, let's meet, is more liable for criminal prosecution than people who show up. I mean, as presumably they're supposed to control them. This is the most important issue, that people will be hesitant to post things on the internet, which is a form of communication. It's chilling to freedom of speech. It's chilling to a freedom of association. And I'm against this law. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see if there's any questions. Thank you all very much for coming forward today and giving your testimony. All right, our next panel is Catherine Moore, Gregory, I'm going to say Fernward, or it's Forward.
Forward.
Forward? Okay, I couldn't tell if it was an E and an O. And then Ann, is it Buell? Ann, late entry. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started? I'll call out one more time.
Hi, my name is Catherine Moore, and I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 1534. I am a stay-at-home mom. My husband and I own a small business in Salem, and this bill would make me a felon right now if this was enacted right now, because I have never been in trouble with the law, but I have been at various protests. I have tweeted out that I'm going to various protests, that I would like other people to meet me at various protests, and there have been acts of civil disobedience that have been committed at those various protests. This law right now would put me as a felon. That is absolutely unacceptable, and I will strongly, strongly urge you to not let this move forward.
All right. Just before we take another testimony, for those who are in the room with cell phones, it would be nice if you would turn them off so we don't disturb our speakers. Thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you, Senators. My name is Greg Forward. I own two small businesses. I've lived in Oregon for 6 months, so I am a newcomer. But I am firmly opposed to a lot of the language in this bill. Specifically, in Section 1, Article 3, it states, the state need not prove that the electronic communication was received by specific persons or that the defendant intended for specific persons to engage in the criminal activity. That basically goes against the Fifth Amendment of due process. That puts the burden of the onus of innocence on us to prove ourselves innocent. That's not right. Also, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty according to the law. There are a number of things that I could cite in here, but I will tell you that I organized a flash mob right on the West Steps February 1st. It was a celebration of our First Amendment rights of freedom of assembly. If I'm going to be charged with a felony, so be it. I firmly disagree with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ann?
Hi, my name is Ann Buell, and I agree with what everyone here has said so far, and I just would like to add that I disagree with this bill because it infringes on my right to free speech. That's all.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz first.
Just a question. You organized a gathering here on the steps, right?
Correct.
Did you get permission to do that before you did it?
I had a permit, yes.
Yeah, okay. So you did it legally. Thank you.
If I could add one thing, please.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It should not be on an organizer. I'm a cause-based concert organizer, fundraising organizer for a number of different causes and charities. It should not be on the organizer if somebody else participates in a criminal activity.
Senator Wissett?
To respond to that, this bill is carefully written to protect you from that. You have to have the willful intent of causing or soliciting someone else to commit a crime in your communication. The fact that you organized a lawful assembly, the fact that you came and occupied some place and weren't disturbing the peace, that has you're not liable for anything. If in fact you followed the law as you did to bring somebody to the Capitol steps and to a group of people, and your intent was not to cause a problem, you lawfully assembled, that was your intent, and someone else went out of their way to cause a problem, you're not liable for anything under this bill because you did not solicit them to do that. You solicited them to come there lawfully, not to do something else. That's specifically how that bill is written. And, you know, I am probably one of the stronger protectors of the Constitution in this building. And we may have dropped the ball on getting it done, but the purpose was to respond to this problem without trampling on the Constitution.
So if I can respond to that, as somebody who has tweeted out and said, I would like, you know, if I tweeted out that we should all get together at a park at 9 p.m. and the park closes at 9 p.m. and we should sit there as a form of civil disobedience, I would be prosecuted under this law. So you are, in effect, saying that you are, that we would then be charged with a felony conviction for a misdemeanor offense. Is that correct? That's what I'm hearing you state.
That could be a possibility.
Okay, and that's what I object to. That's what I object very strongly to, and that could be a possibility.
But you would have to be found in violation of the law in order to do that. You would have to be somehow found in violation of the keeping the peace. And if you did that and you were asked to disperse by a police officer because you in fact were violating the law and you did that, you wouldn't be liable, no.
Okay, so this is against civil disobedience.
Excuse me?
So this law is targeting acts of civil disobedience tweeted out. Is that what I hear you're stating?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Greg?
Sorry. I just need to reiterate one more thing. Again, the state need not prove. That language needs to be amended at the very least.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Thank you all very much for coming
Thank you.
Forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1534 that has not already given testimony? Now I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing.
Yes, a question.
Yes, I'm going to.
Lauren Knight, Council. I am curious. I'm just curious about this. If I ask for people to come to my house and we're going to hit a bank and I'm the organizer and say, all right, you're going to do the driving, you're going to do the guarding outside, I and you are going to go in. You make the demand or I'll hold the guns and make the demand and you're going to get. So we all got our responsibilities. And then we have several more meetings at my house, but between those meetings, I'm using text and emails to sort of tell different other details. Does this also, would this also reach them since it was not the original, it was, you know what I'm saying, the original solicitation, or however you want to describe my activities, were done in person. Those correspondence that took place between the meetings thing, does this affect that in terms of ratcheting up additional charges against me? I'm just curious one way or the other. Do you understand the context of my remarks?
I do, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. I believe that that would be more akin to conspiracy, and your communications via text message, if those communications are crimes of themselves, then yes, it would fall into this bill.
Well, okay, I've decided we're going to hit it on a Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's either going to be this Thursday or that Thursday. If that was in one of the communications, then it fits. I mean, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm just curious. Yeah. It probably would.
I think it could. And I think what counsel's hit on is something that I also recognize, that we already have a bank of laws dealing with conspiracy.
Right.
And in conspiracy, where you actually are conspiring with others to do certain things. So, Senator Courtney, I think in your example, you would definitely have multiple charges that could be brought forward. And if the dialogue continued online and you were, I mean, it would be a fact-based, but if you actually were talking about meeting at some location and you restated that, then I think you could, in fact, have broadness enough to maybe be caught up under this particular statute as it's currently written.
That's good. Thank you very much.
Senator Wissett?
I would follow up on that. As I understand it, and of course I'm not an attorney, but if you can solicit a crime without someone responding to that solicitation, it's my understanding that if that person responds to your solicitation, you are then conspiring together, and it changes the situation. One is soliciting a group of people. If one of those people responds back to you, those two people then, I believe, are in a conspiracy or more. So I think there's where you draw the line.
Yeah, they could be, but you still would have the solicitation that would also be one that would run with the conduct that occurred on the front end. So it wouldn't be, you wouldn't shift from one to the other. That, as we would say in the prosecution business, our tools in the toolbox would have just been expanded, and we could add additional charges to it.
All
right.
I got it.
With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1534. I'm sorry.
Could I speak?
You can, but you weren't on the list, so that's why you weren't being recognized. But please come forward and give us your name.
Thank you.
And your name?
Stephanie Hampton.
Ms. Hampton, go right ahead.
Okay. I'd like to thank Senator Courtney for his question. And I want to turn that around and say he wasn't planning a bank robbery, but say a misdemeanor charge, something about camping, say, in public parks. And my concern about this bill is that it felonizes misdemeanors using communication. I object to this bill because it criminalizes Oregon's First Amendment rights to free speech and assembly. There is no language in this bill exempting this, and I would like to read into the record the Oregon State Constitution Article 1 Bill of Rights, which is my permit to be here. Section 26, assemblages of people, instruction of representatives, application to legislature. No law shall be passed restraining any of the inhabitants of the state from assembling together in a peaceable manner to consult for their common good, nor from instructing their representatives, nor from applying to the legislature for redress of grievances. I feel that this bill perhaps gives too many tools to those who might misuse the laws in order to abridge the free expression of the citizens of Oregon when they speak.
All right, thank you. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1534. I'm also going to make a statement. If you notice, this is one of two bills today that was scheduled for public hearing only. Because of our rules that we have for the short session, it is required that by 5 o'clock today, if a bill is moving forward, it must be posted. So if you do not see 1534 posted after today, that means the bill will not be moving forward this session. With that, we'll move into our next public hearing. And let's see, Council, you're ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we're going to go ahead and go back to the one that Bill's here on. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1528.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1528 comes to you from the Interim Senate Judiciary Committee, defines liquor inspector as full-time employee of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, who is authorized to act as agent of the commission in conducting inspections or investigations, making arrests and seizures. As chair, members of the committee, basically the OLCC agents have had, at least inherently, this power since Prohibition. What this does is clarify and put in statute their limited powers as it relates to enforcing the liquor laws, and within those circumstances, they would have basically the same powers as any police officer or law enforcement official in Oregon. So, chair, members of the committee, you have also the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, and they clarify on Section 4 of the bill on page 3. It says the current bill says a peace officer or a liquor enforcement inspector or an authorized agent of the Oregon Law Control Commission. And the amendment takes out the or an authorized agent of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission that clarifies that to do these police powers, you have to be an enforcement inspector for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. You couldn't be someone that the commission had otherwise designated, for example, another employee of the commission. Chair members of the committee, this bill does not have a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee, but I did get a fiscal impact on the original bill, and it's $128,000.
All right. All right, with that, I have two individuals that have signed up for giving testimony on 1528, Mary Bodkin and Marilyn Lawrence. Why don't you two? And, well, come on up. I've got two on. Oh, I'm sorry. David, you're on here.
And
I apologize.
Telfer, isn't this your bill?
What's that?
Senator Telfer's bill?
Really?
Yeah.
No.
This That's is the next one.
Another bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees today. With me is one of our members, David Green, who is a liquor inspector and enforcement officer in Eugene. And I'm actually only here to offer moral support and help answer questions if I am needed. And with that, I will close my testimony and just sort of sit back and wait. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz and committee members. I've worked for the Liquor Commission as a liquor inspector for approximately 13 years. I am here today as a member of the American Federation
David,
of State County.
David, I need you to put your name on the record, please.
I'm sorry. My name is David Green. I work for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I work as a liquor inspector for that organization. I've done so for approximately 13 years. And I'm here today as a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1528 because I think it's going to improve the working conditions for OLCC employees, and I think it'll make a positive difference for the people of the state. And I think it does this in a number of ways. It clarifies our enforcement authority. It codifies protections concerning assault. It reduces liability for OLCC in the state of Oregon, and it implements standards through certification and increases our professionalism and accountability. It also allows for a one-time grandfathering of current OLCC inspectors who have completed training through DPSST. There's two things that this bill doesn't do, and one of those is that it doesn't expand our enforcement authority, and it doesn't increase financial compensation or change or enhance retirement benefits. The clarity for this bill comes from the changes to ORS 471-775, and basically changes the definition that says that Currently, inspectors have all the authority given to, by statute to peace officers of this state, and it changes it so that inspectors are given authority to enforce law that's related specifically to acts related to alcoholic liquor. The protections and reduced liability come through by inclusion in ORS 161 and 181. And what that does is that it allows inspectors and it protects inspectors when they're taking authorized appropriate action to make arrests and from others who might choose to unlawfully resist our actions in taking lawful action. And by including us in 181, it allows us to make sure that we can be on in licensed businesses and perform the duties that we are charged to do. Through the implementation of the certification for OLCC inspectors, it makes us adhere to standards and expectations that come through DPSST certification, and it enhances our skills and knowledge and requires ethics, and those will be standardized and will be held account to by that agency. So I think that those are the things that I think increase our ability to do our jobs and gives us protections that this bill would allow for. Thank you.
Excellent. Marilyn.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST. The proponents of the bill that's before you today is Senate Bill 1528, approached our department during 2011. Their purpose was to request our assistance in developing language for the concept that they desire to put forward that would bring their liquor enforcement inspectors within our agency's jurisdiction for minimum standards, training, and certification. Section 21 of Senate Bill 1528 is based on those discussions. That language is modeled on the similar language that is in our current statutes for the regulation of police, corrections, and parole and probation officers. The appropriate changes are also made to our definitions. The bill does require OLCC to pay for the mandated basic training that would be developed as required under the bill. There is transition language in Section 28 of Senate Bill 1528, and our understanding from Legislative Council about the effect of that language is that it requires our agency to have the certification program available by July 1 of 2015, and that 18 months later, January of 2017, OLCC liquor enforcement agents would be required to be complying with those certification requirements. Based on Section 28, there would be no fiscal impact to our agency during the rest of the 2011-13 biennium. We would begin the process of developing the minimum standards, curriculum, and administrative rules required during the 2013-15 biennium, and my written testimony provides more detail about what would be entailed in that process. We would anticipate an 18-month development period, and our fiscal impact statement identifies 1.75 limited duration position to oversee those processes. We would then be ready to deliver mandated basic training early in the 2015 and 17 biennium. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions about what implementation would look like.
All right. Question, Senator Dinkfelder first.
Thank you. So I'm reading through the bill. I have a couple of questions here, and I'm assuming that this is in response to, I was going to ask why is this needed now, and I could sort of assume it's in response to some recent incidences that occurred with one of your, or there might have been more than one of your inspectors.
Well, currently, if you're talking about the clarifying our authority, currently the way that the statutes written is that we often have different treatment in terms of some of the actions that we take relate by county depending on the interpretation of the language of because the current statute says basically that we're given all the authority given by statute to peace officer the state, and because we're not located in other statutes, meaning 161, different DAs respond differently to what that means. And so sometimes we will it'll give effect to certain things we do, and sometimes it won't. Related to some of the things that we work on are concerning access to premises and fake IDs and things of that nature. If what you're meaning in terms of the protections, I think that that has to do with currently depends on how the DA interprets our authority, and that sometimes if there's interfering with our duty, sometimes there's what they'll do is if an action happens concerning one of our inspectors, there's different standards that are used to determine what the outcome of that might possibly be. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess I was alluding more to the training, to the DPSST training. So I need to know what kind of training do your officers get now? And I do know we had an incident recently where there were some abuses going on, which we hope is not happening on a widespread basis. And certainly training I always think is a good thing, but I also want to hear how we're going to make sure whether peace officers are trained or not, that type of behavior doesn't happen again. And then the second question would be, I'm sort of amazed that it would take 18 months and three quarters of a position to come up with the training for, this is rocket science. It seems like it's something we could do, and why can't this be done on a contract? Why do we need a position? And I don't know how many new people, it sounds like we're grandfathering in existing employees, so how many new people do we expect to come on board?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, that's why we did the 18 months phase in, is because we really felt like everybody who is currently in the system and doing this job, they are all currently certified already. And so this was a long implementation period anticipating retirements and other vacancies that would be created and over a period of time. And because there's so few inspectors statewide, it would take us 18 months to get a class together again, assuming those vacancies and retirements.
Okay, I will continue listening, but I'm not sure my question's completely answered.
Any other questions? Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman. Are there other witnesses signed up?
There are not at this point.
So can I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
So your peace officers now?
We have all the authority of peace officers of the state.
You don't want to be peace officers?
We do.
Okay.
You want to be better trained peace officers.
So you just want to be trained better?
We want trained better. We also want to have our authority clarified.
But, okay, so they want more than training.
Yeah.
So the DA of Marin County looks at you differently than the DA of Yamhill County. What are we talking about here? Let me be careful here. I am confused as to magnitude of this. What DAs are you talking about that are picking on you?
Well, for example, my understanding is that I've...
Understanding.
David?
Yeah.
Let me answer that question.
Okay.
They came to me, OLCC, because they said at least one deputy district attorney in Multnomah County has challenged whether they have the authority to enforce alcohol laws that the inspectors have been enforcing since I've been a prosecutor, so 25 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much broader it has been interpreted besides that one person in that one office. David?
That's accurate.
So, you won't be upset if I now ask you a question.
Not one bit.
So we got one deputy DA at this time. To the best of your knowledge, my DA in Marion County, they're okay.
They're okay.
We got a deputy DA in Multnomah County. All right. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right. So go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think what this bill also does, you've got to remember the original law literally was written in the 30s, mm-hmm. 1930s, when laws were more general. What this legislative council's office did, they went through in every statute where law enforcement is specifically mentioned with their authority and included these people, so that if you went to the wiretap statute, they're listed there. If you go to the arrest statute, they're listed there, okay? But to the limited purposes of enforcing the Oregon Liquor Control Act. So it's when a deputy district attorney goes through that particular statute that he's running, as you do and all others do, they will see them listed there, rather than having to go to the liquor control statute where there's a general grant of authority, an ambiguous grant of authority. Because that's the way they drafted back in the 30s.
Right. And that's, I mean, one of the issues here is basically if you have an inspector enforcing OLC regulations, and if they are assaulted while they are enforcing those regulations, whether or not the perpetrator could be held accountable for assaulting them as they would be if it was a police officer. So there are some other parts to it, but the reason the bill first came forward was because of at least one office questioning their authority. I have a question for DPSST. This amount of money that has been set forth as to what would be necessary is $128,000 plus. I see that it's other funds. Can you give us a little bit more information as to what the source of that revenue is?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Our agency is funded from the criminal fines and assessments account. There is no provision in this bill for another source for that cost, which would be for the development of the statewide minimum standards, identification of the essential tasks of a liquor control agent, moving OLCC within our general jurisdiction provides that we would need to develop minimum physical standards for the profession, identify then medical standards that would be adopted into administrative rules, and then to ensure that the curriculum that was developed met the statewide minimum standards.
All right. Senator Whitsett.
Comment and a question. Actually, it's my understanding from the CFAA is pretty much akin to the general fund now. I mean, it's a different source, but it's pretty well pooled and used that way. The question for Mr. Green, I thought I understood this pretty well until Senator Courtney asked his question. But in your testimony, you say the current version of that statute gives inspectors and investigators all the authority given by statute to peace officers of this state. This bill changes that to give investigators the authority to enforce the law that is related to alcoholic liquor. That would seem like it would limit your authority from what you do, from that of a full police officer to enforcing the law that is related to alcoholic liquor.
Well, in practice, what our current authority relates to and what we enforce are acts related to alcoholic liquor. And so what this does is it clarifies what our role is in relation to the authority that we have. I don't think that it lessens what our authority is. I think it clarifies what the intent of our charge and our mission is. That makes sense.
So then, as a peace officer, you would be able to enforce, you know, to address the violation of any law, but you're just focused on now, this would focus you more on alcoholic liquor violations, but you'd still be a peace officer from the standpoint of being able to address other law violations.
No, what it happens, what I think where people are getting confused is that they have certain rights and protections that peace officers get, such as retirement, as to how they are seen in the system for PERS. None of this is going to change that, but they have the same eligibility to retire as any peace officer in the state. Their power has always been limited to enforcement of alcohol related offenses. And so what the chair agreed to was to make it explicit that they had that authority, and then a prosecutor could then charge somebody
who assaulted or resisted arrest while they were enforcing those alcohol laws, but they are not today, and they would not be eligible, and they would not be a peace officer in the more general terms of authority that a peace officer has. It would be limited and modified only to enforcement of alcohol laws.
Thank you for that clarification. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I got Senator Dingfelder and then Senator
Okay, Cruz. I will yield to the good senator.
Mr. Chair, a question for you, or for anybody, I guess. Okay, if all we're doing is defining what they're already doing more specifically and giving them the legal protections, why do they need more training? Aren't they already being trained? I would assume the training's already there, they wouldn't have the job.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz and members of the committee, again, Mary Botkin for the record. I think it's important that we understand that training, in-house training, has been acceptable over a long period of time, but with the increase in scrutiny of what peace officers are doing and when you are in actively enforcing the laws that you are required to enforce, we took a look at it and thought, you know, it makes a lot of sense to put these folks under the same jurisdictional training program that other peace officers are in, even though it's a more limited training course and limited in scope to just liquor laws. It is important to have standardized training for everybody who does this work so that everybody, regardless of where they're working, knows what those standards are. It gives the state of Oregon the added protection of having DPSST in a position where licenses can be revoked if officers act out or do inappropriate acts. And I wanted to try and answer a little bit of Senator Dingfelder's question, and I think I did not do that at first because I didn't quite understand it. But Senator, if you're asking us, will this make them more accountable? Yes, it will. Will this make them more professional? Yes, it will. Will it standardize what we expect of them statewide? That is our hope. And I think that, you know, there's no guarantees that you're going to stop all criminal behavior, regardless of where people work. But this gives you an extra layer of protection, and it puts the agency that is the most experienced in, you know, sort of training and scouring out the bad apples before they become employees. And that is our goal. I mean, we want to have a professional system here in place. We want our officers to have the best training available to them. And we think that having an outside agency do that creates another layer of accountability. And that's really what our effort to do is to do here, is to create more accountability and to clarify their authority, to clarify their rights to be in a licensed establishment and to enforce the law. Because we make a lot of money for the state of Oregon, and it would be nice for us to do it in a consistent way, and one that the licensees can respect as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Botkin, could you give us some examples of difficulties that have resulted from a lack of training?
We had an incident in a licensed establishment earlier this year where possibly a little more training, both on the licensee's part as well as on the part of the officer involved, might have resulted in a better outcome, where the officer was sort of physically pushed out of the establishment. In the end, it all turned out okay. But training is always a good thing, both for the licensees as well as for the enforcement officers, and learning how to talk down a situation or
Just for the record, when you're using the term officer, I assume you mean inspector?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you. All right, Senator Dingfelder.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for answering the question. That was the intent of that question. My other question, I think I've answered it because I just found this information online. I was curious how many OLCC inspectors there are, and I found an estimate says about 40. Is that correct?
All right, any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1528? Not hearing anyone or seeing one, we'll close the public hearing. You want to do something, or do you want to hold on to it? We can wait.
Sorry, but I don't mind them, but I'd like to move it without recommendation, not ways and means that mm-hmm. puts any hindrance.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1528, and it looks like at this point we don't have a fiscal, but I believe what we're going to be doing is making a motion that will make sure a fiscal is reviewed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1528 without having a fiscal impact or a revenue impact statement.
Yeah, we will do that. All right, Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1528 without having a fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time.
Right.
Any discussion on the motion?
I just have a question. Are we adopting the dash ones?
We haven't gotten there yet. We have to take...
Because I don't have
that. That should be in your packet of what you received today.
Okay. I get them online, and it wasn't online. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion regarding the motion to consider the bill? Not seeing any, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move... the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1528.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 1528. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1528 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor without recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1528 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a no recommendation with a request from the President's office for subsequent referral of the bill to Ways and Means based on the fiscal that has been attached to the bill. Discussion. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will vote to send this down in Ways and Means. I mean, I certainly think it's it's a good idea to have more training. It's a little disconcerting that there hasn't been consistent training, given the fact that they've been around for a long time. This is not a new position, and I can't imagine this is the first time that it's been an issue. The question for me is, what isn't going to get funded, since we're talking about a zero-sum game here, what isn't going to get funded out of the criminal fines assessment if we're looking at a $178,000 hit? That's not our job. That's ways and $128,000 hit. That's not our job. That's the Ways and Means job. But, of course, I would always advocate for raising the beer and wine tax as a way to pay for it. But certainly, I guess that's why I would vote for this without a recommendation, because I certainly want to see what the impact is fiscally.
All right. So, Senator Cruz next.
Yeah, thank you. And the reason for the no recommendation, I think, obviously, there is training, and I'm not going to say it's inadequate. It may very well be adequate. The fact that they want to change places where it's happening it may be justifiable, but there is not only the money that it's going to cost to do that, but I would like Ways and Means to also be able to take a look at the money currently being used for the training, where it's coming from and what happens to it. So I think it's appropriate that the folks downstairs take a look at this and make take further action as they see fit.
All right, thank you. And I will close with the statement that I think that what the proponents are looking to do is not only have uniformity but consistency, not only with their training but other training that goes on for other law enforcement, to make certain that they're getting the best professional training that's possible as compared to maybe something that's currently in-house. Mm-hmm. Regarding the good senator from Portland, wanting to raise alcohol taxes. Since the relating clause will not allow us to do that, we will not entertain that at this time.
Sorry.
But instead, we'll send it down to
that
Ways and Means.
That was the dash two amendments.
That haven't been printed yet. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And there will be no carrier since it's on its way down to Ways and Means. Okay, with that, we are closing the public hearing, the work session on Senate Bill 1528. We're going to open up our last of our public hearings on Senate Bill 1557.
Senate Bill 1557 is sponsored by Senator Telfer, and I believe she's here today to speak to it. This bill has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact has been issued yet. Senate Bill 1557 makes it unlawful for a minor to consume a controlled substance, and it creates a Class B violation for such consumption and a Class A violation if that consumption happens while operating a motor vehicle.
All right, thank you. Senator Telford, I know you're going to make some openings after that. We'll go through our list to make sure we have the panels as you would like for them to come forward.
Thank you, Chair Plzanski and members of the committee. Yes, and thank you for that comment. I know you think that the Bend Police is here as my escort as a senator from the area. But we do have the chief of police, and we've got a principal here and an SRO officer and a student, so I think I'll direct the panels when they get up here. So what I'll do is just give you some high points, and I do particularly want to thank you for the opportunity to introduce the bill and to have a hearing. Senate Bill 1557 simply makes it unlawful for a minor to be under the influence of a controlled substance. Currently, only alcohol consumption is prohibited, also known as MIP law. This bill was initiated by the Bend Police Department and school resource officers and the area high schools. It's backed by the superintendents from both school districts, as well as parents, teachers, students, municipalities, law enforcement, and various associations, both locally and statewide. The bill would impose a violation in the form of a citation if a minor is exhibiting signs and symptoms attributed to the consumption of an illegal drug. We have some drug recognition experts that I don't know that they're in the room, but I believe the police would be able to address concerns on that in that area. Where this seems to be a real problem is in the schools. Kids are coming to school high, usually on marijuana, but also on other illegal and prescription drugs. School administrators have their hands tied because they're not able to provide sufficient consequences or significant consequences, a real deterrent or adequate intervention. The system that is set up to handle the issue exists within the Juvenile Justice Department, but currently only accommodates unlawful alcohol consumption. We specifically chose to focus on minors because of the increased health issues and adverse effects associated with juvenile drug use, and because we continue to struggle to preserve funding to K through 12. This is an issue that we simply can't ignore. A child who is required by law to be in school should be required to be there, prepared to learn, and not be disruptive to his or her self or others who are trying to learn. We have met with and heard from dozens of people, groups, organizations that have taken an interest in this bill. Many valid issues have been brought to light, and I'd like to work to address those. The purpose of this hearing today is to vet these issues and to get a better understanding of the direction we need to go to address this issue as policymakers. And with that, if there's any specific questions for me, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, I'd like to call up the first panel.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a guess at who the first panel is based on you saying uniform, since there are three names here that ID'd a PD. So we'll go with that, but is there any questions for the senator? If not, Chief Sell, if you'll come forward, I believe it's Chris Carney, and then Mike, is it Mundane?
Mondrian.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. And Chief, we'll let you start off or let your men go.
I think we'll start off with Lieutenant Carney.
All right.
Chair Plzanski, chair members, thank you.
About 2 years ago, I started supervising our school.
I need you to put your name on the record, please.
I apologize. My name is Chris Carney. I'm currently a lieutenant with the City of Bend Police Department, Bend, Oregon.
Thank you.
About 2 years ago, I started supervising the school resource officers, and as part of that supervision, I reviewed all the reports that came to me. Those include citations and written reports. Consistently, 3 to 5 times a week, I would see possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, citations coming through. So through our conversations, it became clear to me that this is what I would call, we can call an epidemic, or a serious problem within our juvenile system and schools, that there are a lot of kids coming to school with the substance on them or under the influence of it. I was also part of our Safe School Alliance, which was Deschutes and Crook County schools. It became clear this was not just a City of Bend, Lapine School District problem. It was in Redmond, it was in Prineville, it was in all our schools. The other thing that became clear is we would have 5 kids off campus, somebody would call them in to smoke marijuana, they go back to the school, the school would address it, they would find one person that might have a pipe with residue on it, and yet you have 3 to 4 people that are under the influence of that marijuana. Law enforcement couldn't take any action against those kids and to get them into a system that could intervene with this process. However, we could cite the one person if they still had the substance on them, if they didn't hide it or discard it before they got on school grounds. One of the things we tried to do is how can we intervene in this process? We, through 23 years in law enforcement, I've known lots of people that have used, who have said, if I just had intervention at an early age, I could have done something. Somebody could have intervened before I became an addict, before I became into the criminal justice system, before I became a burden to society, the cost of housing somebody, the loss of property. We know clearly that a lot of our property crimes, breaking into cars, burglaries, are done by people who are trying to get money to support their habits. So how do we interfere with this? How do we make our youth more protected? So we came up with this concept, if we could make it illegal for them to have it. And if we do it as a violation, it probably won't be as burdensome on the system. One, a violation, we don't have to worry about putting them in custody. We can also put in, as our MIP alcohol law is, they can go to the juvenile system. Juvenile can say, okay, you can go to diversion. Now we've done our intervention. We start to get the education portion in here where the kids are going to some type of counseling. We have Narcotics Anonymous. They can go to mental health, whatever that counseling might be. Those things are already in place. So we realize there won't be an economic impact on the state of Oregon or our local communities to the taxpayer for the burden of trying to produce this. That system's already in place. We have it for the alcohol. That was the main reason why we brought this forward. I know there's several issues, and you'll have some questions I'd be happy to answer, but from there I'll pass it on unless you have questions for me.
We'll take the whole panel, then we'll open up for questions all at once. Go ahead. Okay.
Chair, Senators, thank you for asking me to be here today. My name is Mike Maunder, and I'm a police officer for the City of Bend. I'm a 30-year police officer, and I've been in the schools. This is my third time I've worked in the schools, and I have a history of working with addiction issues, all the way from minors all the way up to adults. I just want to kind of point out some things that we are now currently seeing. This year alone, I have already dealt with 4 grade school kids who are under the influence of marijuana specifically. 4. I think that is crazy. And those 4 kids have been involved in criminal activity. One broke into a school, another one set fires, and when you talk to these kids, they don't think it's an issue because marijuana does not hurt them. At the high school level, the high school I'm at has over 1,350 kids. I'm dealing with mental health issues now. I've talked to kids almost daily anymore about suicide issues, and when we start getting down to the point of what I'm talking to them about, it comes to their addiction. I have their parents begging me to try to find something to do to force them to get some help. I have no resources. If the school suspends them, all it does is put them out on the streets to where they can just keep on doing what they're doing,
After their suspension is over, they come back to the schools. The interesting thing when we talk about minor in possession of alcohol is the kids are afraid to get an MIP ticket now. Because if they get the second MIP ticket, the first one's diversion, we intervene, we get them the education of what it does to them. On the second one, they lose their license. They are afraid. They don't want to lose their license. But it's not. They don't lose their license. There's no criminal side to them if they come and I deal with them and they're under the influence of something. They can just do whatever they want. They all feel that it's illegal, or it was illegal. Now they all know it's not. Lieutenant Carney talked about finding a kid with a pipe. Not anymore. They use an apple. Because why? If we get them with the pipe, we can cite them for less than an ounce of marijuana. If they use an apple, after they smoke out of the apple, they eat the apple and they throw the core away. So now we have nothing. This is an interesting world. I've been on the Oregon School Resource Officer Board, where I've also met with other people throughout the state. This is not just in Bend, Oregon. This is an issue that is impacting everybody all across the board throughout the whole state, and there's no answers for it. So what I see every day is I see kids, as soon as I see their grades come down, they start losing attendance, we're losing them, and we have nothing. So they come to school high, they get suspended for 10 days, they can come back in 3 if they get a drug test. So what we're asking today is to make this a violation to where we can start intervening with some of these kids before it gets to the level of where we're putting kids either basically in a coffin, or we're dealing with them where they're dealing in a car, or they're committing suicide. And I strongly believe that that's where we're heading to right now.
Chief. Senator Porzanski, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sale. I'm police chief for the city of Bend. I'm going to talk very broadly about how this bill will impact our city and I think cities across Oregon in our tourism and also in our private businesses. And then I will comment briefly on a position taken by the Oregon District Attorney's Association. When you look at the city of Bend in particular and our downtown core, I've had numerous meetings with our business community to try to address their concerns about what is occurring in our downtown area and in our parks. And one of the constant issues that they have is people under the influence of narcotics impacting their businesses negatively, impacting their tourism negatively. And the constant barrage of calls that we as a police department take and the requests that we get to deal with these people. And there is no way for us to deal with them. We can't cite them for anything. So they continue to just be a problem for our businesses. They continue to be a drain on the resources of the police department because we deal with them over and over on a continual basis, and we really have no tool that allows us to deal with these people effectively. And one of my goals under this bill, the same as with the officers that work for me, is how do we bring intervention to these people, particularly these young people. And right now, we can't force intervention. Under this scenario where you have a violation, and specifically in the city of Bend, we do have diversion programs, where our hope would be that we could divert people that we do cite and to get this problem taken care of at a very young age and provide the intervention outside of the criminal justice agencies to take care of the problem, and hopefully we don't get the reoccurrence. Secondarily, I'd like to talk about the Oregon District Attorney's Association, a position that they have taken. They have honed in on possession by consumption to have proof and resource issues, specifically lack of an infield confirmation. Again, they're going after the assumption that we want to prove specifically what drug someone is under the influence of, and that's not what this bill does. So they cite the lack of a reliable field test to tell us what this is. Well, even if we were trying to do this, field test is not a mandatory test, as it is not with alcohol. We cannot force someone to take a field test for alcohol to determine alcohol content, nor would we be able to force someone to take a field test to determine types of narcotics, which is not what we want to do. So as they work through that thought process, they then fall on the need to collect urine, increase work of the crime lab, and that's not what will happen with this particular bill. This is not a criminal citation. It is a violation. There will be no increase to the crime lab. There will be no need for us to collect urine. This is done specifically based on the training that we currently give our police officers to be able to recognize the signs and symptoms of being under the influence of narcotics. And with that, I will be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today, and certainly appreciate the fact that you're here trying to figure out a better way to solve a persistent problem that we have. Question I have about diversion programs. Are there, sounds to me, I mean, once you have issued this and you're saying let's get them in a diversion program to help them make sure that they're not just repeat offenders and then obviously costing the system and continuing down the path that we're trying to divert them from. So what, as far as the availability diversion programs, for instance, in your area, can you walk me through what would happen next? You issue this violation, you then have them in custody, send them through a diversion program. Can you sort of walk me through for your county how that would work? I'm pretty familiar with Multnomah County. But.
Basically, in Deschutes County, if I were to write you a ticket for MIP by consumption, you would go down to the juvenile court and what they call this community justice portion, not the actual court, and they would sit down with you and talk to you, and then they would send you to like a alcohol class on what the effects of alcohol might have on you and what the long-term results are, and that would be the first step. If they were to get a second one, then that could be brought before the juvenile judge. Or they could keep it in the community justice side, too, where they would have a stiffer penalty for that. But basically, the diversion side would be an education side of what the effects are, long-term, short-term. And just to touch on just one thing, the long-term effects of specifically marijuana now have become a lot worse. And I was just in a class where they talked about the brain damage it causes for people under the age of 23. So the idea would be to educate them along those lines.
And follow up. And because we're talking about minors here, I'm assuming the family, or if, you know, assuming they have family in the area, are involved in these programs. And can you talk about that? And also, what is the current statistics as far as reduction in recidivism with these programs?
I can talk a little bit more specific about the City of Bend and the Bend Police Department's diversion program. We currently have an in-house program. We have a contract with juvenile to take certain diversion cases, and we have our own in-house diversion program within the police department. So what we do is we try to sit down with the offending individual and their family and get some buy-in to what we're going to do with these kids. Understanding that this is kind of a one-time shot for them for diversion. After that, we won't be taking them into the program. So we try to work with the family, with the individual, to set up a program that is individualized for that person and the issues we're finding that we have to deal with with that particular individual. And work with the schools when we can to see how that's going to work back and forth. I don't have the actual statistics of the recidivism of our program. My understanding at this point in time as we're looking at this program is that we have very, very low recidivism rates in the program. That the most of the kids that have gone through our diversion are not re-entering the criminal justice system at a later time.
Senator concerned with it.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Thank you guys for being here. This is a very important issue. Just a couple of questions for my clarification. In the absence of a laboratory test to confirm that the person was under the influence, what is the level of evidence required? Is it preponderance of evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt? What is it?
On a violation, it would be a preponderance of the evidence.
Okay. And the second question is, if a minor pleads guilty or is found guilty under preponderance of evidence, is there any ramification for the parent of that minor?
Not currently as listed in this bill that would, you know, hold the parent liable.
Is there any other statute that does that?
Not that I'm aware of. About the only statutes that would apply to the parents and to holding them liable would be probably under the civil statutes of, you know, property damage, property recovery, that type of thing.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Sir, could I elaborate on that just a bit? I just dealt with an issue for a school attendance in a grade school where the mother wasn't getting her children to school, and there is a violation statute on that. And I did cite that person for that, for not, because her kids had missed so much school and she refused to bring them there.
Yeah, I think it's called lack of supervision.
Failure to supervise a child. Yeah,
not widely used that I know of in our area, and I doubt in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I have two more panels of people that wanted to give testimony. Senator Court, do you have a question? All right. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, I'm going to go ahead and call the other people that are up, probably from Bend, that are more than 100 miles away from the Capitol. Archie Hamilton, Tyler Joyce, and Dave Holmberg. And due to time, I'm going to go ahead and let you get started. Please give us your name and your testimony, please.
My name is Dave, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Holmberg, and I'm a school administrator from the Bend area. I've been in school administration for about 20 years and 32 or 33 years in Oregon education overall. In my capacity, I work with, in student management, I work with substance use issues on a regular basis, and I thought I could point out a couple of things that are pretty typical to what we see in schools, particularly the high school level where I work now. One of the concerns I think that I've heard expressed is has to do with whether or not it can be proved that a student had consumed or been under the influence of some type of a controlled substance, and the level of proof. And what I've seen over the years is that typically students they'll just tell you. You ask them, they clearly have the appearance of being under the influence, and you talk to them about that, and typically they'll just say, yeah, we smoked. And so it's not a matter of us just sort of deciding based on our own judgment that they are without really any confirmation. They typically just tell you. And so one of the concerns that the current difference in the law in Oregon creates is because it is a violation to be under the influence of alcohol but not under other controlled substances, it almost has the effect of creating what you might refer to as a protected class within the school of substance users who feel that because of the fact that they know that they can't be cited and there's not a violation, that it's somehow the school system is saying to them that that's okay. And that has a concern. It concerns me, and I think for the mission of our schools and the community, I think it sets up kind of an inconsistency. Often we work with parents who are, you know, very responsible, and they come to the school when there's a call that there's been a rule violation involving substance use, and the parents will come in and you know, they'll get their questions answered about what happened at the school, and they know there's a suspension from the school, and then they ask about the citation because they just assume that if their student is under the influence of a controlled substance, there's going to be a citation, and they're really shocked and surprised when there's not. And so I think that again, it kind of gets to the mission of the schools in the state and what our view is, that if our culture is one of rights and responsibilities, that the message seems to be that if you choose one level of intoxicant over another, you actually have more rights. And so that's something that we concerns us at the school level. There are students who care less about a school suspension that they see as a relatively minor consequence, but they very much care about getting a citation, as has been mentioned before. And I think from a point of view of consistency in the message of the schools to the youth of our communities, that we would like to see that consistency there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who would like to go next?
I would. Senator Przanski and the chair, my name is Archie Hamilton, and I'm a drug and alcohol counselor. I work at a youth facility in Sisters, Oregon, doing the addiction studies there for the last 3.5 years. But my testimony today is not that of a counselor, it's that of a recovering addict. Methamphetamine was my drug of choice. I've been clean since March the 7th of 2005. This March, I will be celebrating 7 years clean off all drugs, including alcohol and tobacco. And since that day, my life has changed dramatically. I started drinking in the 7th grade, and after receiving a few minor in possession by consumption of alcohol tickets, I learned early on how to manipulate the system. I was really good at finding loopholes. And marijuana would become my drug of choice. So I found out that if I came to school high on marijuana every day, it was a good way for me to skate under the system, under the radar. I would continue using marijuana till the ninth grade. I was coming to school high on marijuana every day, and I ended up failing out of the 11th grade due to my marijuana addiction. I went on to start taking minimum wage jobs. My drug abuse would eventually turn into an addiction where I was introduced to methamphetamine. And from there, my addiction took me on a lot of tours. I've been arrested in Deschutes County 57 times. I toured the Oregon prison system 5 times. And I ended up in a lot of places, a lot of courtrooms, a lot of jail cells, and a lot of prison yards. A little bit about my bottom. I woke up at 41 years old. I was living in a broke-down car. I could not put together one day clean for my parole officer, and when I showed up at my family's house, they would call the police on me. I was desperate enough at that point to find a different way to live. I'm here to testify today. I truly believe with all my heart, had there been some more intervention at an early age, when I was just in the abuse stage of marijuana, just maybe I could have got my life turned around before I would go on to become a career criminal, hurt everybody that I loved, and create a lot of victims in the community. I was a menace to society. I work with adolescents now. Well, you know, getting turned around at that early age is very crucial when we're still in the use and abuse stage, because once we cross that line from abuse to addiction, the choice is gone. Our brain gets hijacked. We go on to use against our will and create a lot of victims in the destructive lifestyle that we come to know. So I truly believe in this bill. I really think it's gonna really help getting some of that intervention to some of those younger, to our adolescents before they come on, they go on to live the lifestyle that I come to know. Thank you for letting me be here today.
All right, thank you, Tyler.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Tyler Joyce. I am 16 years old. I'm here to testify today as that minor and recovering addict that this bill does affect. A little bit about me. I am almost a little over 18 months clean now. My drug of choice was methamphetamine, and I did, in fact, use drugs a lot in school because of the fact that I could not get in trouble for it. Like Archie, I did, in fact, get MIP for alcohol, not necessarily by consumption, but just for having alcohol on me in school. And, you know, I soon figured out because of friends that, you know, I could not get in trouble for being under the influence of drugs at school. And I basically started going to school high all the time because I knew that I could get away with it. And that was my mindset, you know, being 16 years old, being a teenager, like anything I could get away with, I was going to do. I know of many, many people that go to school high on a daily basis. You know, you can walk into our Redmond High School and I can, you know, point there, there, and there, and people are on under the influence because of the fact that they know they can't get in trouble for it. I know a lot of people don't carry drugs on them because they know they can get in trouble for that, but they do come to school high, and it is, you know, very not only disruptive to the learning experience there, but it is, it's affecting their lives and destroying their lives. I know that had I had some sort of intervention during the school, well, that's what ended up getting me clean during, you know, this time, and you know, had I had some sort of intervention while I was in school for being under the influence of drugs, my life probably would have changed right then and there, you know, because I didn't look at what I was doing as wrong because of the fact that I had no consequence for what I was doing. And I guess that's my testimony.
All right. Thank you very much. Were there any questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. I have two other people that have signed up to give testimony today, Daryl Fuller and Tim. Is it Lowen?
Lowen.
Okay. If you two would come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The previous witnesses with the Bend Police Department did a wonderful job of explaining the bill, so I won't add anything more other than to say that your elected sheriffs support the bill and hope that you'll pass it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Tim?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. I'm here today representing the Juvenile Department Directors Association. We take no position on this bill, but we did want to bring to the attention of the committee possible issues with that. With controlled substances, there are many, and oftentimes those are difficult to determine in the field, do take some testing oftentimes, at least within our juvenile departments, your analysis testing to determine what kind of controlled substance it may be. These are oftentimes we're dealing with kids already on probation. We already have some authority to do those kinds of things. Unlike alcohol, controlled substances are not a status offense. So under the current bill for MIP alcohol, that really only applies to youth up till age 21, the age of majority, so that they are no longer illegal for them to use. Controlled substances are very different than that, and so we just want to make that bring that to the attention that if you pass a violation for one class of folks, it may be considered for all classes. And then the possibility there could be lack of funding in terms of the prosecution or investigation of these kinds of things in our current system. Just for consideration of that, there could be a financial impact.
All right, thank you. Some questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Was there anyone else? I didn't have anyone else scheduled. Y'all two need to come up. We got just a couple of minutes. And committee members, I know we're out at 2:45. For those who need to leave, feel free to leave.
My name is Dana Scheider. I didn't come here today intending to testify on this issue, but since I'm here, I thought I would add to the things that I've just heard from the people who came before me. I'd like to acknowledge the gentleman who just spoke. I second his remarks on this topic. What I'm hearing here is a lot of emotion, and that's understandable. It's understandable that we're concerned about children being addicted to drugs. That only makes sense. It's understandable that we're concerned about the social problems that cause that and are caused by that. But I'm concerned that this legislation may be informed more by emotions and by logic. Research doesn't necessarily indicate, for instance, that people who use marijuana are more prone to other drugs or to crime. It's a difficult question, and researchers disagree about the nature of and the relationships between substance use and social problems. So my remarks on this bill would be that legislation should be informed by a thorough review of research on the nature of these problems and on the relationships between them, and should be crafted to address the roots of the problems. By the time a child is using drugs, the system has already failed. We need to be addressing that failure and not only the fact that the child has used drugs. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Your name?
Yeah, my name is Daniel Dreyer. I'm in the same position, didn't come to testify on it, so I'll be brief. I also have concerns because I have friends whose lives have been turned upside down, not by drug addiction, but by fairly minor possession convictions. One friend in particular, it's his own fault, of course, but he got a possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. And as a consequence, he has not been able to find employment in the normal society. Having that conviction has essentially cut him out of polite society, and he works, you know, under the table type jobs, and that pushes him more in the direction of fraternizing with other drug users and so forth. Drug convictions also have a fairly serious impact on eligibility for financial aid for people who want to go to college. I'm not saying that this bill is out and out bad, but I think that those should be addressed. There should be some way to move your life forward once you have that kind of conviction, because even if you go through a diversion program, if you then can't get financial aid and you can't get a job, it's an awful lot harder to stay on the straight and narrow. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Any questions? Thank you very much.
With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing.
Yes, one question.
Yes, Senator.
What impact would this have on getting a driver's license? If young persons did this and they did not have their driver's license, what impact does this have?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Courtney, I'm unsure of that.
Okay.
I can check and get back to you.
And I think in rural Oregon, a lot of the young people have hunting licenses, things, and I'm just curious to the extent. I'm totally unfamiliar with that. What impact would it have on those kinds of things? I'm just sort of curious about that kind of law.
I will look into that and get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Any other, Senator Wissett?
A question for counsel. We heard that these are violations and that they can be sustained in court by a preponderance of evidence. We have the testimony, just written testimony here from the Oregon District Attorney. It talks about the lack of infield confirmation, need to collect urine, blood samples, increased workload for crime lab. This would indicate that the district attorneys, in my mind, it would indicate that the district attorneys believe that this requires a lab confirmation in order to prosecute. So I guess the question is, which is it?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, my understanding is that it would require some sort of physical confirmation of a specific controlled substance.
Here's the situation. Even though it's a preponderance of the evidence, they go before the court. In this case, it would be a judge because it's not a crime, so it can't be in front of a jury. The judge, he or she, would have to make a determination based on the facts that were presented to them. If you have an officer that's testifying, and if it's a DRE drug recognition expert, he or she is going to testify as to what they see in the way of symptoms and physically, et cetera. That would be evidence. But there could also be evidence that would come in from the other side rebutting that. And if you didn't have some means of, let's say, scientific testing, the trier of fact would be free to say yes or no as to whether they think the case was proven. Yes, the threshold is less, little, it's the lowest, but it doesn't mean it's a sure shot thing just because you get the test.
Preponderance of evidence, yeah.
That's correct. All right, any other questions? Again, I want to thank everyone that's come forward, not only in this bill, but all the other bills we had today. We will close the hearing, just to be official, on Senate Bill 1557, and we're adjourned for the day. We'll be back on Wednesday at 1 p.m. Thank you.